Hi, I'm Dr. Monique Nugent, your host. And today on Prescription for Admission, we welcome Dr. Charlie Ray for a conversation about hospital medicine and the role of a hospitalist in your care. Dr. Ray is the founding director of the VA Hospital's Medicine Analytics Team, which aims to study how to improve care at VA hospitals across the United States. In addition to this, Dr. Ray is a director of the San Francisco VA's Quality Scholars Program and is a senior deputy editor for the Journal of Hospital Medicine. Thank you for joining me and enjoy the show. So we are here with Dr. Charlie Ray. Thank you so much for joining me today, Charlie. I really appreciate you being here. Dr. Ray is out there in San Francisco. How is the West Coast treating you?
Oh, it's great, Dr. Nugent. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to be one of your guests on this podcast. You and I share such a great history and background together. So I'm happy to support you in this conversation and what it is you're trying to do in the world. I think it's good stuff.
Thank you. So Charlie and I have known each other for years. We were both residents at Loma Linda University Medical Center in internal medicine. And now we are both hospitalists. So I'm a hospitalist, you're a hospitalist. Do you still find that people don't know what a hospitalist does
when
it comes to...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know about you, but I have this conversation constantly. People, you know, like, oh, what do you do for work? Like, I'm a physician, and I generally start off with that. Yeah. And then, well, what kind of doctor? Okay, all right, here comes the hard part. I'm a hospitalist. And I would say about 30% of the time, people go, oh, okay, I know what a hospitalist is. But the other, you know, 70% of the time, people go, well, what's that? I'm like, okay, all right.
Yeah.
I got to give my spiel.
So do you ever get the people who think you said you're a hospice?
I do get hospice. Yeah, I do get hospice.
When I walk into the room, like, oh, I'm Dr. Nugent, I'm going to be your hospitalist for the day. And they're like, you're the hospice. And then I feel horrible. horrible because they're there for like a cellulitis of the toe or something totally that I would not
all of a sudden. You're right. The hospice doctor walked in.
So what is your spiel, Charlie? How do you like explain to people what we do?
Yeah. So what I oftentimes say, and I think this is a fairly common sort of analogy, is I say I'm the quarterback if you're in the hospital. So I start off and I say, look, the only time you'll really see a hospitalist is if you're sick enough to be obviously hospitalized. Your primary care doctor will take care of you in the outpatient setting. But if you're in the hospital, you know, your primary care doctor's too busy to sort of come see you. The medicine's become too advanced. And 25 years ago, we came up with the idea of the hospitalist. And that's who I am. And so the hospitalist is the person who sort of runs the show. And again, the analogy I use is a quarterback. So if you've got a heart problem, I pull in the cardiologist. If you've got a kidney problem, I'll pull in the kidney doctor. If you've got a lung problem, we'll pull in the lung doctor. And then together as a team, we all sort of coordinate in and around your care to provide you the best possible care that we can. And so I'm sort of that central coordinating individual. And I think that gets the idea across. And then sometimes, obviously, we're just the only doctor on the team because we're well-equipped enough to care for, you know, the vast majority of things that we see. But whenever we have questions, we reach out and we get that input. So that's what I've used. I don't know. How do you explain it?
That's good. I'm going to steal some of it. So what I see is if you come to the emergency department, you're too sick to leave, you're over the age of 18, but you don't need the ICU, then I'm the doctor that you're going to see. And I will be the main person taking care of your care while I coordinate with other specialists. Yours is a lot more friendly. The quarterback is a lot more friendly. So I will definitely
Obviously it's a North American centric analogy and probably wouldn't work in another country. But I've found that works pretty well in most circumstances.
So like you mentioned, we are actually a fairly young specialty, right?
Yeah.
And 25 years, something along those lines.
Right.
And what value do you feel, clearly, I feel like we feel bring a lot of value, but what value do you feel we bring to healthcare and hospitalized?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's a question, I mean, researchers, economists have been sort of trying to tease that question apart and find value in quantitative sort of measures over the past 25 years. So I would argue, this is my argument. And I'll give a little bit of a historical perspective on this. So in 1999, Bob Wachter, Monique, you know Bob Wachter, so one of the leading thought leaders for hospital medicine, writes this seminal paper that says, hospital medicine and the care of hospitalized patients has become highly complex. It's become too hard for a primary care doctor to potentially do on their own. And we need a new model. And so here on the West Coast at UCSF, they started the hospitalist model. And what that changed was, is prior to that, your primary care doctor was the physician who would care for you in the inpatient setting. So they would see patients in the morning, and then in the afternoon or at lunch, they would run across to the hospital across the street and see patients there. And that became really difficult when, you know, there were economic sort of factors that were sort of pushing primary care doctors to see more patients in the outpatient setting, and the reimbursement for the inpatient side started dropping. And so there were a lot of factors sort of pushing a wedge in between the inpatient and the outpatient setting. Medicine started advancing. Medicine became more complicated. We started taking care of much more complicated patients in the hospital. So Monique, you know this, like we have some really complicated patients, to the sense where this is what I tell my learners frequently. I say 50 to 60 years ago, this patient could have died, but they come into the hospital, they spend 5 days with us, and they walk out. And that should give you some idea of the complexity of medicine that's taking place in the hospital setting. And so that's one of the singular reasons that I think hospital medicine brings value, is medicine has become more complex. So you need individuals who are focused on those hospital medicine specific areas, because you don't want your primary care doctor doing those things, because primary care has become more complex as well. And so we need this specialization in some sense in order to provide high value, high quality care.
The other thing that I don't think people realize is that the complications that occur in the hospital are quite specific to the hospital, right? There are really specific things that you want to prevent. Things that can occur in a hospital will bring different rates of morbidity and mortality than if they happened outside of the hospital, right? And so it is much more specialized than people realize.
Yeah.
I have two professional pet peeves about being a hospitalist.
Yeah.
Is when people refer to it hospitalist medicine. I don't know if they do that out west. Here they say it all the time. This is the hospitalist office. I practice hospitalist medicine. I'm like, no, you practice hospital medicine, right? A cardiologist doesn't practice cardiologist.
I am a specialist, right?
But the other one is to put just in front of my my moniker by how you refer to me. Like, oh, this is just the hospitalist. The amount of training and specialty care that I'm giving you to assure that you're safe in those 5 days.
Right.
And to accomplish a lot of things in those 5 days,
right.
You know, isn't just. And so professionally, those are two of my professional pet peeves. Because the care has become, like you said, really complicated. And the expectations financially are also very different. So hospitalists are available to discharge and admit patients in a safe manner 24/7, like all of the time. Not creating that backlog. You might still get a backlog of patients, but imagine what it was when your primary care doctor would just get a call from the emergency room like, oh, we're going to admit your patient, and then you have to wait for that primary care doctor to make their way over to the hospital or whatever kind of orders over the phone, right? There's safety issues about giving telephone orders. There's certain things that happen. Rapid responses is a huge beneficial thing that's hospital medicine driven. Right. And you don't want to wait till it gets so bad that a person's heart stops.
Right.
They stop intervening. And so it is a really complicated specialty that I think doesn't warrant a just in front of the name.
Absolutely. I could not agree with that more. And I think, you know, just pulling on that thread a little bit further, and we've used the word complicated over and over again, but I think of a specific example, and this is something that maybe some folks out there, you know, might recognize. So we use blood thinners oftentimes in our patients. And a new blood thinner has come out over the past 15 years. We call them DOACs, right? And I remember Monique, when you and I were training warfarin, we used warfarin on everybody, and we had a good sense of what, how to use that, how to manipulate that, and that type of thing. And then DOACs have come out, and they are incredibly complicated medications to manage. when to start them, how much to give to somebody. You know, it's all based on their renal function and their age and their weight. And I'm talking about one medication here, just one medication. And I don't know about your patients, Bonnie, but many of my patients have 10, 15, 20 different medications. And we have to manage those in an acute setting and then make really pivotal, difficult decisions about when to start those medications sort of as they transition out of the hospital into their, back home. And that's just one medicine. And we have to figure out hundreds of those little sort of issues throughout the day. That's why hospital medicine exists, so that your primary care doctor can focus on all the other complicated things that they have to deal with as well. And so, is it a perfect system? No. But I think it works well for the way in which medicine has morphed and evolved over the years into these sort of specialized sectors.
Yeah, I remember when Lovenox, which is an injectable warfarin pill, was the fancy one on the block.
Right.
And you used to have to keep people hospitalized to qualify to get the Lovenox. And now, like, you just kind of, you got a thing, here's some Lovenox, we'll pick it up at CVS, right? It's kind of like an afterthought. But the reason I bring that up is because the other thing that we navigate are the financial implications of people's care, the social implications of hospitalizations, and planning for discharges and getting people back into their community or back into their world as best as possible, right? And so once you come into the hospital, it's a different set of rules of what goes on financially, and then also another set of rules when you're leaving, depending on where you're going. And working with social workers and case managers to make sure that we can align the care so that people are getting the things that they need to be able to return to the community. Because it can be very complicated for us to navigate as the professionals with the professionals helping us. And then when I sit down and I think about the friends and family members who are supporting the patients, that's for me why I'm doing this, why I'm here, you know, to try and give people some information as to learn how to navigate this, because I never know. Like, they'll come to me, they're like, Dr. Nugent, we need a prior auth. And I'm like, but you didn't need one on like bed two. They're like, because he's got Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah.
This one has Medi-Cal, Medi-Coo. And I'm like, I don't know what those mean. But tell me what to sign so that this man can get his Lovenox.
Right.
And they're like, oh no, it's not for Lovenox, it's for this. I'm like, how do we get this person the things that they need?
You're hitting on something that I think is just so incredibly important in and around, like, about hospital medicine and how hospitals even operate too. And because oftentimes patients will just see us as the individual who walks in, right? You'll walk in, you'll see the patient, you'll talk with the patient, and then you walk out. And so if you asked that patient who's in charge of their care or who's running their care, they will single out that hospitalist. But as you just sort of alluded to, we walk into that room, we do our little dance, and we come out of the room, and then who do we start talking to? RN case managers, social workers, charge nurses, the nurse at the bedside, everybody. There's this whole sort of slew of people that are behind you and supporting you that it would be impossible to do our job without those folks. And so as much as I can, whenever I'm talking with patients and sort of interacting around, you know, be it medicine, be it discharge, be it whatever, you know, I'm oftentimes trying to do my best to give all due credit. I'm like, look, that wasn't me. That was, you know, Sharon over here who did this, or Tony who helped me do that. And so that's one of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand about hospital medicine. It's a very team-based process, which I think is what actually makes it a lot of fun for me as well.
Exactly that. I spend a lot of time telling people, talk to your case manager. You have to you have to ask them that thing, you know.
Yeah.
What about this facility? And part of it is I do take a step back from a certain amount of those things because the rules change so many times. New facilities open up. Contracts are made that, like, I would feel horrible if I give someone a piece of advice to go to X, Y, and Z institution and it's not within their financial capabilities or their insurer doesn't contract with them. So for me, one of my biggest tips for patients and their families is always, always touch base with the case manager and be really open and honest about the things that you need. Like, what's going on in your world so that they can help you set up for the next step. Because
correct.
You're 100% right, we come up with the plan, but the plan doesn't have to happen in the hospital for 5 days.
Yeah.
If at the end of the 5 days you need more, the plan can continue on somewhere else.
Yeah.
And you're usually sick of us by then anyway, right?
Yeah.
You're usually ready to go. And
right.
How can we get you back into your world? And that's the most important thing. And those are the people who do that. So that's one of my biggest tips to patients. Your top two tips for patients on how they can get the most out of their time with you as their hospitalist.
Yeah, that's a good question. So my first tip, my first thing that I'll say, and this tip is going to focus a little bit more on the family side, but I think it's helpful. And that is, be physically present at the bedside as much as you can. And I say that with the caveat that I understand people work, we have jobs, we have all these other responsibilities. So I'm just gonna set that aside, but I also acknowledge that that's a barrier to this occurring as well. But let me tell you why I think being physically present at the bedside is really helpful. So if you can understand what your hospitalist is going through, what their day looks like, they show up at 7:30, they're rounding for 3 or 4 hours in the morning, they're getting paged by the ER, by the nurses, they're having to admit a patient downstairs. So oftentimes your physician is being pulled in so many directions. But I have found over the years that if I enter into a patient's room, and obviously I'm engaging with the patient, telling them what's going on, what tests we're doing today, what they can expect and whatnot. But I've often found that if there's a family member at the bedside, for whatever reason, it slows me down. It goes, okay, I've got, my audience is bigger. It's a different audience. And so I slow down, I pull up the chair, I go, what questions do you have? And so it physically causes me to slow down. The other thing it does is it brings an advocate into the patient side of things. Because when you're sick, you're not feeling well. We've all been there. You're not thinking straight. Things are hard to digest. You know, you're not feeling well. You're not batting 1,000. So having that family member at the bedside to advocate for you, to ask those questions that you just can't think of, I think is really helpful. And then from my hospice perspective, it does. It makes me slow down and try to explain things as best I can to as many people. And then the next day when I'm rounding, I know, you know, I'm like, oh, I wonder if his wife is going to be there, or her sister is going to be there today. You know, I'll get there in time so that, you know, I can give them that time to give them that information as well. So I think that's the first thing I would say. Go ahead.
That's a great tip. That's really great. And I would say that I actually depend on family members to tell me how someone is doing.
I
do. And so don't like, as a family member or the friend visiting, don't think you're not contributing, right? Because I'll often say, like, how's mom looking? Is this what mom is like? And they're like, oh no, she's still not really herself,
right?
Oh no, this is perfectly how she does. You know, she's confused in the morning, but by afternoon she's like, okay, you know.
Yeah.
So that's one big thing that family members really do, is to help us get more clinical information. And then the other thing you alluded to about advocating, the other part of advocating is I often find family members might tell on the patient a little bit.
No.
They do that where I'm like, okay, you know, dad has said that he's ready to go. He's worked with physical therapy. He's walked down the hall two, three times. He's doing good. And then the daughter will look and say, like, has anyone tried him on stairs?
Yeah.
And he'll say, you know, and I'm like, he didn't say he had any stairs. Dad, there's 4 stairs to get up the house, you know. And then it turns the conversation, right?
Yeah.
But that's advocating. That's advocating for the patient. And we really do rely on people to be there. And like you said, slow us down, make us speak a little bit more clearly. We've been seeing your loved one for 3 days. We have this rapport, you know, and now you come in and that may change it a little bit so that we're revisiting topics that we thought we had covered. So that's a really, really great topic.
Yeah, I love everything you said there. And I would echo all of that. We oftentimes joke that, you know, I work at the San Francisco VA hospital, so predominantly older men. And the men who get the best care are those with their wives right there, like advocating for them, telling on them, you know, like, nope, he has a few more drinks than that, and that type of thing. So it is enlightening and always fun to sort of get the quote-unquote truth from family members. So you asked for two. Let me see if I can throw another one at you. The other question, this is going to be a question that I think patients can ask and family members can ask of their hospitalist physician. And that's, do I need to stay in this hospital for this workup? And you can use, this is the way I say it, you can use it two sides of a coin. So the first side of the coin is this, is I'm going to paint a scenario for you. Sometimes we hold on to patients because we want to get all the tests done before we send them out. We kind of want to wrap everything up in a nice little bow. That's just we are. We're just type A people. We want to get everything done and then send people out. But Monique, as you know, sometimes things can be done as an outpatient. Sometimes workups can be done in the outpatient setting. And if you as a patient, you're feeling great, you feel okay in some sense, and I'm not always saying that feeling okay is discharge criteria, but you feel okay, you're trying to get to your daughter's wedding, or you know, something big is really motivating you to get out of the hospital. And if you say, doc, can we do this as an outpatient? That sometimes forces your hospitalist to think critically about, you know what, yeah, we can do that MRI as an outpatient, or yeah, we can follow up as, you know, we can do this later on down the line. And so it can be used as a tool to potentially get you out of the hospital sooner than might have occurred. But you can use this question on the other side as well, in sort of a more inquisitive, like, hey doc, should we be staying in the hospital for this right now? Like, this feels big. And what do I mean by that? Is on that same token, sometimes hospitals are like, nope, get them in, get them out. But as we all know, sometimes it's really efficient to just get everything done as well. So I know I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth here a little bit, but at times, if you sort of force your hospitalist to sort of think about, you know what, let's do this extra little thing and then we'll get you out of here, that can also save you some time. And then there are oftentimes diagnoses that come in, advanced leukemias or lymphomas, where we need to start chemotherapy on those patients, you know, 2 hours from now. And so if you're really itching to get out of the hospital, but your hospitalist is thinking, you know what, this might be something kind of aggressive and bad, I want to hold on to you, and I want to get the answer before we send you out, that's good for you to know as a patient as well. So I think just really begging the question of what can be done inpatient, and what can be done outpatient, and what should be done? Should we be staying here or should we sort of be going home? I think it's just an empowering question that can allow for some really nice discussion between the patient and the hospitalist.
That's really a great one, because there is so much care that can be delivered outside of the home. You know, we're giving IV antibiotics to people at home. People are doing their dialysis sessions at home. Visiting nurses can come and do wound care. Complex wound care can be done at home. There are ways to get you back into the community and into your life, but there's also a backlog of ability to get things like colonoscopies. It can be very difficult to come by as an outpatient, right?
Yeah.
So asking that question, like, do I really need to be here for this colonoscopy? You might get from your hospitalist, oh, it's going to be so hard to get you that colonoscopy as an outpatient. And that's great information for you to know and something to like check off of your box, right?
Yep.
And help you to get that GI follow-up.
Right.
We spoke a little earlier about rules changing inside and outside of the hospital. So when you leave, and you know, yeah, that MRI may be able to be done, but it might require prior auth.
Yeah.
And having that frank conversation so that you know, if I'm going to leave here to get that echo, it's not I'm not going to show up on Tuesday, it's I have to go to the cardiologist's office. How do I line that up? How do I get these things? Because if it's not available in the community, like you said, take advantage.
Yeah.
The cardiologist is there. Take advantage. Yeah. The echo tech is there. Take advantage and get the things that you need.
Yeah, I use that same reasoning sometimes with patients, especially if you're like, I want to do this as an outpatient. And sometimes I'll sort of go, you can. You might have to pay for it, though. You stay with me. You know, this is the line I use. Have lunch with us. Stay and have lunch with us tonight. And let's see if we can get that echo done before you leave. And 90% of the time that works. But you know, I think the essence of my tip is kind of what you were sort of alluding to there a little bit, Monique, which is have these conversations. Ask these sort of hard to ask, deeper conversations, or deeper questions rather, about what needs to be done here, what can be done as an outpatient, is it easier in an outpatient, is it harder in the outpatient setting? And your hospital should have some idea of that. Every hospital system is a little bit different too. At my shop, it's wait 6 weeks type of thing. And so I think, again, digging into, having these hard conversations can be helpful for patients and their families.
Yeah, and this is where I talk to that case manager and that
right
comes in,
right?
Because they'll know the rules.
Right.
You know, I could be over here being like, oh yeah, perfect, that'll be fine. You can totally see that neurologist.
Yeah.
And they'll come back and be like, actually, they cannot go to see that person. It's out of network.
Yeah.
We need, they yeah. don't only do like EMGs on Thursdays in the rain, you know, like
yep.
real specific yep. things like that. So make sure you're touching base with them and talking with them. I'm going to apologize because I glossed over something you brought in a few times about your learners and your work at the VA, and
yeah.
and like you were working with a really specific patient population. You also do research,
right.
and I'm so sorry. I wanted to like dive a little bit into that yeah. earlier into our conversation. You can tell us a bit about like working in a healthcare system that also, you know, has an outpatient system and, you know,
yeah.
nursing homes and is a little bit more comprehensive than
yeah.
some of the other healthcare systems. And also, what does that do for your work as a researcher in hospital medicine and a teacher?
Oh, man. Yeah, there's so much to unpack in that. I'm trying to think of a concise way to sort of answer that in some way. So, as I stated earlier, I work in the VA healthcare system, which is the largest integrated healthcare system in the United States. The VA covers, I think it's right around 9 million individuals. So there's no other healthcare system that covers that many individuals. Obviously, it's a very specific patient population, predominantly men, predominantly older men as well. And I've worked in this healthcare system for the past 10 years, and Monique and I both trained in a VA healthcare system. I think most people will be interested to know that the vast majority of doctors actually out there have trained in VAs because the institutions that you train at oftentimes are affiliated with VAs. So if you've ever met a doctor, you've met a doctor who's probably trained and spent some time at a VA. Being an integrated healthcare system, I think is absolutely fantastic. It makes my job much easier because I know what's available. I know the primary care physicians because they're right across the hall, right across the street from me. I literally call them up and say, hey, you know, I've got your patient here. When do you want to see him again? And they're like, great, I'll run over right now and go see them while they're in the hospital. And then let's get it all set up so that we can sort of see them in the outpatient setting. And so on some larger 30,000 foot level, I argue that working in an integrated healthcare system like the VA, and there are plenty of others out there, you know, places like Intermountain Health or Kaiser are two, at least on the west coast of the United States, that sort of work in similar fashion, I think is, from a practitioner standpoint, a great place to sort of operate from. The health records are well integrated. I can see what's happening in the outpatient side. I can see what's happening on the inpatient side. And that helps me as a provider as well. So if you're lucky enough, in my humble opinion, to receive care in a healthcare system that does have that tight integration between the inpatient and outpatient setting, that's fantastic. Because as Monique and I have sort of alluded to, navigating the interface between those two things can be so hard. So incredibly hard.
Well, I think we're getting close to our time. I cannot thank you more for being my first guest here.
I'm so
excited to see your face for all of our listeners and watchers. I was looking forward to this conversation greatly because Charlie he's just a really wonderful physician, prolific in lots and lots of ways. I was just teasing him that I picked up our latest, you know, industry magazine, you know, hospital medicine magazine. His face was on the cover because of all the great work he does and the research he does. He's a wonderful teacher. And for your listeners who are learners also, you know, they benefit from some time with him. So I really do thank you for that. And we've talked about really heavy stuff. So I'm going to ask you just lighter stuff on the way out.
Yeah.
What would you, if you were to pick a TV show, a movie, a whatever, that gives the best representation of hospital medicine, what would it be? And then I'm going to ask you the worst representation of hospital medicine.
All right.
I have my own.
Oh, this is a great question. Best representation. It's going to be a little off, but I think people get me. So, and it's also going to date me a little bit. So to me, I think one of the best representations of what happens in the hospital on some larger level is the television show ER. If folks can go back that far.
Clooney was young and had dark hair.
Yeah.
Eric LaSalle.
There you go.
Oh, God, I forget his name.
Eric LaSalle. Yeah, he was the surgeon. And there were some great folks that sort of passed through that show. Noah Wiley. So I didn't realize this at the time. So that was a show that I grew up on. I would argue it was somewhat influential in me becoming a physician, because you're like watching this, and I thought it was so cool. Like watching Noah Wiley's character, I can do this now, you know, retrospectively. Watching him fumble as a medical student in some of those episodes, and then like how he started as a surgeon and then became an ER doctor, and that like circuitous pathway that he had to, you know, go through, because that's what we all did. When we enter into medicine, you have no clue what you're doing. You're fumbling along. You're just trying not to mess up. But, you know, you go four or five seasons in and he becomes this grizzled, you know, the great doctor that everyone loves and respects. And to me, it's like, that's a really good representation of, you know, the arc of how people become physicians, is sort of that character. And I think the show jumped the shark, you know, years down the line when they got tired of, you know, writing real world stuff. And who knows? I think at some point it kind of fell off. But to me, it's just a good representation of sort of what's happening in the hospital, how people are evolving in their roles. A lot of teamwork. I remember that. I remember it felt like a family on that show. And as we were sort of talking about, like, you kind of develop a family in hospital medicine. Your case managers and social workers end up being some of your really good friends. The nurses end up being some of your best friends as well. So I would argue that that's a great representation of inpatient medicine. What about you, Monique?
I'm going to agree with you that they did jump the shark, like a what? Because people kept dying.
Yeah.
Like, I remember, like, someone got stabbed. And then, like, another person gets down, patient.
Right.
Like, a surgeon's arm gets chopped off.
But right.
I don't think they jump the shark any more than Grey's Anatomy, right?
Because
in Grey's
Anatomy,
and to listeners out there, if you're a resident, and the residency has a mortality rate of Grey's Anatomy, like, residents are dying.
Don't go there. Right.
You know, like the number of residents who were killed off there. I was like, this is an unsafe environment. Like,
right.
CGME needs to look into this. Like, no one's talking about work hours.
Work hours aren't an issue anymore. No, we're way beyond work hours.
Keep getting shot. Like, what's happening here? I actually really love Scrubs.
That's
a go-to. Absolutely. Really good one. And Dr. Cox was often made to be like the foil, like the angry, evil, grizzly doctor. But I loved what he represented it as a hospitalist, because that's what he was.
Yeah. Right?
Was the guy who understood, and we all know that physician who knows every pathology and the greater experience that the patient is having. And dealing with that. Like how, the patient has this thing, but it's affecting them in a bigger way. And I also liked, God, I forgot his name, the chief of medicine guy, the little older man.
Yeah, I know who you're referring to.
Yeah, they always kind of made him out to be this evil guy. What I think happens in hospital administration, that people assume the more senior physicians or the physicians in positions where they oversee departments, people kind of see them as like out of touch, but they're not seeing the other things that they're dealing with. And the other things that they're dealing with to maintain your practice environment comes at a financial cost, right? And so there is a lot of balancing what the institution is looking for and what your physicians need to be able to practice. I think, to me, he was a little bit of a tragic character. The most tragic being Ted, the lawyer, clearly. Like, it was always falling out. But I always thought the chief of medicine, to me, was this kind of tragic character, because in the end, you would see him trying to do really good things that nobody knew was
nobody
happening.
Nobody appreciated.
And the docs were just like, I just want to practice. And they're not understanding what it takes for them to just be able to practice.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Wow. I didn't think we were going to go this deep on Scrubs, but wow.
It's a great show. Okay. So 2 minutes, give me your worst. What is your worst?
I can't say
Grey's Anatomy. We are ready.
No. House. House was the worst. Let me explain my reasoning. A person with that personality would just not last. And, you know, it's not realistic. You know, one of my mentors once said, you know, Charlie, we work in a world where everyone is brilliant And so you can't be mean. We throw brilliance out. Like, oh, it's okay. We've got another brilliant person standing right behind you that can work. And they're nice. And so you have to be kind. You have to be nice. So that was one reason why I just thought that was just a ridiculous sort of show. And then, as you know, Monique, getting into sort of the nitty-gritty details, it was just like not the way we operate. It's not the way we go about diagnosing things. We don't like flip through people's genetic DNA, you know, and try to find an answer that way. Or problems don't reveal themselves through spontaneity. It's, you know, generally a tincture of time and lots of work and that type of thing. So I just never found it realistic and was always put off by his gruff attitude.
Yeah, yeah. No, he was a problem. And you're right. I've never actually heard that, like, verbalized that way, but it's very true that, yeah, like, you're going to be a colleague much longer than you are a trainee. So you have to learn how to get along, and you have to, right, you know, be able to practice in a way where people want to talk to you.
Right.
Or for the patient's safety, right? Because, like, yeah, if you can't speak to me, if you feel like I'm going to take your head off, then the patient's going to suffer when you cower in the corner. Yeah. Well, and also, like, breaking into people's homes to, like, look at...
Just committing misdemeanors and felonies to make diagnoses. You don't do that for your patients?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, okay. You know, I'm going to go with a newer show called The Resident.
Oh, yes.
But, like, I hate that guy's character. Like, the like, sanctimoniousness of him. But what I really dislike about it is how it dismisses the senior physicians as, like, you know, lazy or unethical or this.
Yeah.
And that. When, like, in medicine, we look to our senior physicians to teach us those things.
Right.
And I remember two specific instances where I had a physician who was more senior than me that I was like, I will never be that person.
Yeah.
And just watching how they interacted, I was like, this is a sentinel moment in my practice. I will never be that. Another physician, it was like moments afterwards, and I was like, and that's who I was. And we look to our senior physicians to teach us that. So like, not all senior physicians are just throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and then the resident is the only one with some kind of ethics, right? That's like, there are ethics committees. There are ways that we keep each other in check. And not to say that people don't do shady things, right? But it just like makes the senior physician seem so, like, dumb and unethical. Because he's the only one. He'll be like, well, have we tried vancomycin? And they're like, vancomycin! You know? And I'm like, okay, guy. Like, you know?
Right.
So, like, you're the resident. Like, you're likely just trying to get through your queue, whatever call. You're not sitting around having time to, you know? I think senior physicians are better than that.
I would agree. I would. And I want to point out something that I thought you said was really smart there, especially for learners that are sort of listening in to this conversation. It's when you look up, when you're training, you know, everyone at first is above you. And so you're just looking up and you think everyone is golden. You know, you think everybody is perfect. But after a while you go, no, like, that individual was really good, and that individual was really good. And we oftentimes key on the positive people, but we don't key on the negative people. And I oftentimes tell people, I was like, look, if I'm doing something, if I'm practicing medicine to my learners, I go, this is the way I do it. But I recognize that you may not like the way I do it. It may not fit your style. Don't do it. Like, learn the positives from people, but also learn the things that you don't want to do or the way you don't want to act from your sort of more senior level physicians. And that's okay as well, like, because that's going to form who you are as a physician as you grow.
It's very true. Very true. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with me, Charlie. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I really appreciate your time, and I had a blast chatting, and get to see your face again. So this was very exciting.
This was so much fun, Monique. I really appreciate the invitation, and being here with you, learning from you, is fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, you guys have a good one.